The national security community has warned us that Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential election is only a preview of what Russia might do in the 2018 and 2020 elections. Today's guest argues that Russian intervention in American life is even more serious now than even that dire prediction. He's Casey Michel this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm your host, Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend, G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Every week, we take a critical look at the story shaping American public life. This week, we're joined by Casey Michel, a journalist and Russian affairs expert who is documenting the ties between Russia and the American far right. His work's been published in Politico, Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, and The New Republic, among others. Casey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we've dedicated several episodes of Story in the Public Square to Russia's use of information warfare, political warfare, whatever you want to call it. You know, the use of information to achieve political objectives. Mm-hmm. We have not, before today, looked at specific ties between Russia and organizations operating within the United States. But you have. So in the broadest terms possible, what is the story? What are those links between Russia and American political groups?
Sure. So I think there are two primary areas we can go with that. One, dealing with everything we've seen come out as it pertains to the Trump campaign, the Trump presidency over the past few weeks, past few months, better part of the past year now. That is something that's been well covered, well documented, and as we see day by day, something else comes out, seems to be some new individual in a new meeting, whatever it may be, some new email. What I've been focused on, my research and my work has been focused on, are actors, movements, groups extraneous to the Trump campaign, however still supportive of. So these are actors and movements on the far right, things like white nationalists and the alt-right, fundamentalist Christian movements, as well as separatist movements here in the U.S. that look to Russia, that look to actors in the Kremlin, and in certain instances find a mutual affection, a mutual support for one another, with the Kremlin and Kremlin-linked actors providing either networking opportunities, conferences, support that they can for these actors and these movements to continue and to expand and to have a broader political impact here in the U.S.
And who are some of these actors and some of these groups, U.S. groups?
Sure. So some of these groups focused, I've done a lot of work as it pertains to white supremacists and white nationalists, individuals like Richard Spencer, Sam Dixon, Jared Taylor. For those who follow white nationalists here in the U.S., those are some of the more prominent individuals. Also people like Matthew Heimbach, who is an out-and-out white supremacist based here in the U.S., who again look to Russia as a model they would like to see bring to bear here in the U.S., some of whom have already traveled to Russia for these conferences of like-minded Western white nationalists and white supremacists. So that's one area. You have fundamentalist Christians, those on the so-called religious right, who over the past few years, even over the past decade, have been traveling to Russia, building up links with those in Russia, some of whom are Kremlin officials, organizing, again, conferences to help pass and support anti-abortion or anti-gay legislation, and hopefully create models they can bring back to the U.S. And then there are these separatists as well. Not necessarily of the far right variant. They are all over the political spectrum. Some are far right, some are far left. Nonetheless, looking to Russia for support for their movements here in the U.S. to help fragment, fracture, break off their states, their territories from the U.S. In a reprise of what the Soviet Union went through back in 1991.
So why are they looking to Russia to do this? There are other places one might look contemporaneously or historically, but they're looking to Russia. Why?
They are looking to Russia because Russia is providing support. We have seen over the past 2 years two conferences that have taken place, one in 2015, one in 2016, that organized American and broader Western separatists from places like Texas, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, as well as Scotland, Catalonia. Again, those latter two being more advanced secession and actual on-the-ground supported secession movements. In 2015 and 2016, we saw these individuals gather in Moscow to swap best practices, to have networking opportunities, to support Russia in the Russian state media, and Vladimir Putin especially. And the Russian actors have only been too happy to help set up these conferences. In 2016, we saw a further escalation of that support in that the Kremlin actually funded the group to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars, this Russian group that was organizing these conferences. Some of that money went to flying Texas secessionists out to Russia, setting them up in Russia. Some of it went to providing a rent-free space for a California embassy in Moscow, which, as far as anyone can tell, is the first foreign embassy for a state seeking secession since at least the Civil War era, even though the Confederates never set up any formal embassy abroad. So these are the types of links, the types of actors, and the types of movements that I've been following and that have continued gestating over the past few years and that haven't gotten a lot of coverage, especially given everything we've seen related to Russia and the Trump campaign. Mm.
So, I mean, you really started to hit on that. Why has it flown under the radar, as it were? I mean, this is a rather startling thing to be hearing.
And we should say that, I mean, you've been reporting on
this. Yes, you have, of course.
In prominent outlets, Politico, Foreign Policy, a number of others. Right. It's not like this is completely buried under a rock, but right. Why hasn't it reached a broader mainstream audience, I guess, is the question.
I think there are a couple components to that. One, again, being that everything is being drowned out by the Trump presidency and the Trump campaign and continued ties and revelations therein to Russia. The other is that secession in the U.S. has been something of a farce since the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. It remains illegal following an 1869 Supreme Court ruling, Texas versus White. Secession is illegal. The Civil War essentially settled that. There aren't any broad-based movements in support, the likes of which we've seen in places like Scotland or Catalonia or even in places like northern Italy. Even though we see these actors in states like Texas and California and Hawaii, as well as in Puerto Rico, flying to Moscow, it doesn't have the broad-based support yet to force Washington's hand or to force Austin's or Sacramento's hand, which is one reason I think that it hasn't gotten a lot of attention thus far. There's something of a laughingstock. There's still something of a fringe group, an organization that said, obviously, the California secession movement has gained notable steam since the election inauguration of Donald Trump. There was a Reuters poll a couple months ago that said 1 in 3 Californians are open to secession. Again, it's illegal. It's illogical. Mm-hmm. It's very unlikely to happen, at least in the near to midterm future. But these are the links and networks that are being constructed.
Let's get a little bit granular about CalExit.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
Because there are, I think you've documented some of the ties between leaders of the CalExit movement and Russia.
Right. So there is a gentleman named Louis Marinelli, who up until last month was the formal head of the California secession movement. He's from New York originally. He's not originally a Californian. At some point over the past few years, he actually moved to Russia, Yekaterinburg, in Siberia. And he led the California secession movement from his home in Russia. Now, he would fly back to California from time to time. He said he was in Russia because his wife had immigration issues. She was a Russian national. He also said he couldn't live under the American flag. He also said the rent in California was too high. So he gave a couple different answers as to why he was in Russia itself. He was pushing and supporting California secession, again, from Russia. And a couple months ago, he was there at the unveiling of the California embassy in Moscow, which, again, was provided rent-free by an organization that is funded by the Kremlin. There were media there. There were pictures of Putin and Hugo Chavez and Bashar al-Assad alongside this California embassy banner. Now, he has since been ousted from the organization because the other people think, within the organization, think rightfully, that that was a terrible PR move, and it has done remarkable damage to the cause of California secession. And there's a very real argument that this gentleman, Mr. Marinelli, has done more damage to American secession movements since anyone since the Civil War. But he remains based in Russia, and just last week they actually picked him back up, and he's now an official advisor to the campaign. He's no longer the head. Mm. But he is once more an official part of California secession.
And in California, because of the ability of citizens to put questions on ballots, mm-hmm. it's conceivable that if they get enough signatures, this could be a ballot question in the foreseeable future in California.
Right. Their plan is to have two ballot measures for the foreseeable future sometime within Trump's first term as president. One that would say whether or not we want to go through with a secession, and then the second one saying whether or not we're going to go through a secession right now. So it's a little bit of a convoluted way of gathering steam rather than going for a one-off ballot initiative. But you're exactly right. If they get sufficient number of signatures, they can put it on the ballot. Yeah. And this is something that, again, not a lot of people are paying attention to, not a lot of people are focused on. Had Hillary Clinton won the election in 2016, we'd be having this conversation in Texas. Obviously, the Texas secession movement and organization is far more developed than that in California. The question of Texas secession nearly landed on the Texas 2016 GOP primary ballot, was eventually voted down. But these are real discussions that are taking place with real people that point to the ongoing spiraling partisanship here in the U.S., as well as the gridlock they perceive in Washington, and they would like to take it into their own hands.
So if I'm the so-called average citizen of California, mm-hmm. who reads the papers, watches the news, follows politics, but maybe isn't too passionate one side or the other, why would I be interested in secession, and would I actually vote for it?
Well, that's a great question, Wayne. I don't know what the answer to that would be, and if we have ballot is today versus next year versus 2 years from now. Again, many things can change, just as we've seen over the past few months. Depends on how the Trump administration goes. Depends on whether or not Trump is reelected in 2020. Again, the Reuters poll showed that 1 in 3 Californians are at least sympathetic to the idea of an independent California. California, unlike similar to Texas, has its own history of an independence or a quasi-independence when it was back in the 1850s, although no foreign governments ever recognized California independence. For Texas, a handful of states and countries did. I couldn't tell you right now whether or not the Californian, average Californian, would support this. I would say no, but it'll be interesting to see where we are, given internal migration patterns and given the political dynamics of America right now, where we are in a few years.
Has Jerry Brown spoken to this issue at all? I mean, he is the governor, and he's a very powerful man, the sixth largest economy. If California were a separate nation, he's got a lot of power and influence, and he's got a Democratic assembly, and the world listens to Jerry Brown.
Governor Brown, to the best of my knowledge, has not commented directly on the California secession issue in and of itself. However, a couple months ago, he referred to California as a separate nation, which is something that governors in Texas have not even gone so far as to describe their own states.
And he has also charted a course independent of Washington on things like climate mm-hmm. and energy mm-hmm. In reaction to the Trump administration. But the question that I keep coming back to is, so we're going to talk more about Russia's involvement here, but the broader narrative of secession and separate seems to me to be a fundamental threat to the republic.
Yes.
Right? Because the idea is that if you don't like the results of who won a given presidential election, you're going to up and out.
Right.
That is terrifying to me.
Right.
Why does it resonate, even with to the extent that it does, in places like California, Texas, wherever else?
Well, states like California and Texas, there are a handful of reasons for that. One, given their size, their scope, their economic capacity, the capacity for self-governance that already exists within those states. They have significant trading ports and trading routes already available to them, and they both have something of an independent or a history of independence that they can look back to in the 19th century. As it pertains to the logic of secession, it is it parallels what the Confederates went through back in 1861. They didn't like the results of a Democratic election, the largely free and fair election, and so they said, we're going to leave, and we're going to fracture the republic as we do. Obviously, the California and Texas secession movements are significantly different than what the Confederates attempted back in the 1860s, but the logic is much the same. They don't like the results, so they're just going to leave.
I'm going to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program is broadcast 3 times each weekend on Sirius XM's popular Politics of the United States, the POTUS Channel 124. Subscribers to Sirius XM can also download past episodes anytime on the Sirius XM app. The show is produced by an incredible crew at Rhode Island PBS. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island. You can follow me on Twitter at J.M. Lutis. In the co-host chair is my friend and colleague, award-winning journalist G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. You can follow Wayne at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is journalist and Russia expert Casey Michel. He tweets at C.J. Michel, and that's spelled C.J. M-I-C-H-E-L. In fact, Casey, you and I met via Twitter, so it can be fruitful. Let's come back to Russia's role in all of this, though. What is Russia trying to achieve?
Jim, I think that's a great question. And I think there are a few different answers to that. On the one hand, there is simply an attempt to sow division and chaos, both domestically as well as within transatlantic relations, and support for secession movements in places like the U.S. or the U.K. or Spain or Italy is part and parcel with that attempt. a distraction to allow Russia to expand its own sense of superiority, its own sovereignty within the post-Soviet space, to distract the U.S. from pointing out Russian human rights violations, what have you, any number of those reasons. There is also an additional component that there are actors within the Kremlin and surrounding the Kremlin that still view the U.S. as responsible, or largely responsible, for the Soviet Union's fracture in 1991. They view the U.S. as supporting Ukrainian nationalists, Baltic nationalists, and even attempting to sow secessionist seeds in places like Central Asia. Now, this is ignoring, again, the Bush administration, the first Bush administration's views on Soviet disintegration. Maybe you guys remember the Chicken Kiev speech that George H.W. Bush gave back in 1991, where he talked about what he called suicidal nationalism, attempting to tamp down on Ukrainian nationalism at the time while Ukraine was still part of the Soviet Union. Now, this, again, the Soviet Union's fracture was not in America's interest at the time. However, there are individuals within the Kremlin that view the U.S. as having meddled domestically and would like to see something ever return or a comeuppance or whatever term you would like, and support these movements in Texas, California, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, to do much the same to the U.S.
Is any of that support that Russia gives, the Kremlin gives, or indirectly the Kremlin gives, illegal under U.S. law?
That is a great question, Wayne. And the FEC actually has been examining whether or not the embassy that opened up in Moscow a couple months ago and has since closed, technically it is closed right now, although to the best of my knowledge, all the material remains there, and Mr. Marinelli himself is still based in Russia. They are questioning whether or not that is an in-kind a gift or donation, receipt of some sort from a foreign government to a political party, because this Yes California group is affiliated with a political party, the Yes California Party in California itself. So there's a question about whether or not that was actually illegal. And that's all kinds of morality or optics aside. I don't know. But that is something that remains to be seen. And it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward.
You know, there's one of the things that has struck me about the conversation around the set of issues in general is that I don't think anybody ever contemplated needing to pass a law to say, don't work with a foreign intelligence service, don't take material assistance from a foreign power to, you know, put a secession question on a state ballot. Because I don't think anybody ever thought that was necessary. So have we crossed some sort of proverbial Rubicon here in terms of what's acceptable behavior by folks working in American politics?
There was evidence that during the Soviet period, Moscow supported North American and European secession movements in and of themselves. There are links that emerged with KGB and Quebecois separatist movement back in the 60s and 70s. We've never seen anything of this magnitude, certainly in the forms of direct or indirect funding that we've seen over the past few months from the Kremlin to the group organizing these Western secession movements, and then in turn to California and Texas secession movements. You know, the question about whether or not we've passed some kind of Rubicon, I think, is answered insofar as the developments we've seen over the past week, 2 weeks, as it pertains to the emails that came from Donald Trump Jr. in the New York Times. That was certainly a Rubicon that was crossed and indicative of a willingness among certain American actors and movements to look to hostile foreign powers for support.
Does Vladimir Putin directly control these efforts, or does he sort of know what's going on, or sort of subtly encourage it, or is he sitting in the Kremlin going, they follow my directive, or I like the outcome? What's his, do you have any sense of his role?
Right. As it pertains to support for secession movements, the likelihood is that he is, if he's aware, at least just faintly aware. I should say, at most, only faintly aware. He is not directing these conferences. He's likely not directing these payments insofar as he was directing operations against the U.S. during the 2016 election. That said, there is an atmosphere he has helped create over the past 17 years now that has allowed actors within the Kremlin and tied to the Kremlin to pursue projects such as the one we've seen with these secession movements, such as the links we've seen among those on the far right, white nationalists, white ethno-state separatists as well. If he's not necessarily directing it, he's nonetheless created the atmosphere for other actors to allocate Kremlin funds to support these organizations as part of a broader campaign against the West and the U.S. especially.
You've described in Politico and elsewhere that Russia under Putin has emerged as sort of the leader of the West, of the West's Christian right.
Yeah.
explain that for us.
Sure. So over the past few years, I would say over the past 3 or 4 years, we have seen increasing rhetoric from far-right, religious-right actors in Europe, but especially in the U.S., looking to Russia as a model, as a paradigm they would like to see implemented in the U.S. They view Putin as a faithful Christian who is implementing godly goals in Russia. They pay little attention to his KGB history and his work during the Soviet period. They pay little attention to his broader governance in and of itself, his authoritarianism, his campaign against journalists, what have you. They simply see the relationship he has cultivated with the Russian Orthodox Church, as well as the anti-abortion and anti-LGBT legislation that has been passed under President Putin over the past few years, and say, this is the man we need, this is the man we want, this is the man that we are willing to follow, and we would like to see his type, his leadership, and his legislation implemented in the U.S.
So I don't know if you can answer this question, but now is this phenomena organic, or is there some direction involved here?
I don't know that they are mutually exclusive. I think it may be a bit of both. Again, we see individuals, prominent individuals in the American evangelical and religious right community, cultivating relationships with those both within and close to the Kremlin. One of the most prominent organizations pushing anti-gay and anti-abortion legislation from the religious right spectrum here in the U.S. is called the World Congress of Families. That was actually a brainchild of American and Russian fundamentalist Christians back in the 1990s. And one of the most recent conferences was held in Moscow just a couple years ago, in which they praised President Putin for his leadership, and they, reinforced rhetoric that they would like to see that style of leadership, especially that type of legislation, implemented here in the U.S. Some of the members of the board for that organization are close to President Putin himself, if no longer in his inner circle. As it pertains to direction and specific directive from President Putin himself, again, can't say, but he has created an atmosphere in which these individuals, these movements, these networks have been allowed to flourish.
This is consistent with a broader Russian political objective.
Absolutely.
I think it's fair to say that this would be an understatement, that Vladimir Putin is a ruthless leader.
I think that is a perfectly
correct
fair, synopsis.
So how, if you profess to be Christian, can you balance what he is alleged to have done or has done to political opponents with your view of Christianity? This is not very Christ-like to have your opponents disappear or wind up mysteriously dead or...
No, you're right.
And there's a long list of things.
Yes.
How do you reconcile that?
There is no attempt at reconciliation. It's simply ignoring those threads, those realities, those developments, and focusing simply on the anti-abortion, anti-LGBT legislation. Even his things like Russia's campaign in Syria, American far-right, religious-right actors point to as saying he is upholding Russia's Christian backbone, its Christian history, its attempt at creating something of a, as they call it, a third Rome in Moscow. This is for them the last best hope at some kind of religious right state. They simply ignore all those other threads. They ignore the multi-confessional aspect of Russia. Again, Russia has the largest mosque in all of Europe. Obviously, the numerous Buddhist and Muslim republics within Russia, those are simply ignored. And they focus instead on Putin the man, Putin the myth, Putin the appearance, and the legislation that comes alongside.
So what should we be doing about this? I mean, this is, I think, sort of like five-alarm fire kind of stuff.
That's a great question, Jim, and I wish there was an easy fix. I wish there was an easy answer. I think obviously shining light on something like this and pointing out for what it is, which is looking to hostile foreign actors for support against domestic opponents here in the U.S., looking to support from hostile foreign actors against other Americans, whether they be in the White House, whether they be on the ground, state legislators, what have you. I think pointing it out, highlighting it, and emphasizing the fact that this is, as others have said, potentially treasonous behavior, others have said simply immoral behavior, what have you. This is behavior, these are movements that deserve to be paid attention to, deserve to be focused on, deserve to be followed and covered, and deserve to be pushed back against now more than ever.
Is that something that the U.S. government ought to be doing? So in the Cold War, you know, there was a whole apparatus designed to fight a battle for ideas across the world, including, frankly, for domestic and European audiences as well.
Sure.
Has that battle been joined?
That is a potential. You know, the concept of containment or a neo-containment against Putin's Russia is certainly something that's been discussed, obviously more so during the Obama administration following events in Ukraine and Crimea over the past few years. And something like you're describing would be part and parcel with this new broader policy of containment of Russia. And that containment takes many forms, whether it's cybersecurity or security aspects in places like Syria and Ukraine, the sanctions policy. As it pertains to specific policies to push back, you know, if these separatists want to fly to Moscow, that's their right. I don't think that they should necessarily be denied that right. However, those links need to be highlighted, should be highlighted, and if there are any illegalities as it pertains to taking foreign support for separatist movements or political parties here in the U.S., those should be pursued. All legal avenues should be pursued.
It's not just the separatist elements and the Christian elements that we've been talking about that have, in some sense, allied themselves with Putin. There are people who don't belong to either camp who don't seem to be bothered by his ties to America, shall we call it, his role in the 2016 election, and so forth and so on. So that isn't these, you know, groups out here. That's some people in the middle. Why? This continues to puzzle me.
There is as obviously we're all aware, and I'm sure many of the viewers are aware as well, a highly partisan atmosphere in the U.S. that has developed over the past 8, 10, 12 years that allows many of those who are in many other aspects, patriotic Americans, nonetheless feel that it is fine to accept support from a hostile foreign power. You know, President Trump's latest defense of his son's meeting with who he thought would be a Russian government official, helping with Russia's campaign to support President Trump. You know, President Trump said, anyone would have done this. Any politician would have done this. It's just part of the game. That ignores the fact that any other number of politicians actually didn't do that. In 1960, the Kennedy camp turned down offers from help from Moscow. 1968, Hubert Humphrey's campaign turned down offers of help from Moscow. They didn't even hear them out. They said, no, we don't want anything to do with it. Thank you, but no thank you. President Trump and his team, on the other hand, they set the pace, they set the tone, and they continue to set the rhetoric behind accepting this kind of help from a place like Moscow.
I've worked in American politics, and I can tell you that that's not how it's done. Casey Michel, this is a fascinating conversation, an important conversation. Thank you so much for being with us. He's Casey Michel. That's all the time we have, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit PellCenter.org, where you can also catch up on past episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.